Blog Talk Radio.
Rawson, and this is Spiritual Connections Radio, and I want to welcome everybody to another great show. As you know, we're on every Thursday from 9:30 to 10:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and of course, if you miss any part of the show, you can get it off of the replays. Unfortunately, we will not have our great co-host, Pamela Latour, with us this evening. She is actually sick. And will not be on the show tonight. As you know, she normally helps me co-host the show, and we'll send her all kinds of healing and love and everything towards her as she's not feeling well. And while we're talking about her, as you know, me and Pam started Spiritual Connections Radio. I've lost track of time at this point. I want to say it was about a year. And you know, through part of that process, she had come up with some ideas to actually go off and start what she calls the Sister Radio Show. And we're so happy about this new thing that she's doing. Actually, it's not so new. She's been doing it for quite a few months now. But to find out more about a lot of the stuff that she's doing, you can either go to her website, which is www.pamelalatour, that's PamelaTour.com, or you can go to PamLatourRadio.com to actually see all the great shows and everything she has on. So really excited about that. For any of you out there who have been tracking me, you know, generally if you wait a few months, I'll end up in your neck of the woods. And, you know, it's been a very busy year for me traveling all around the United States and even over to France. So the newest move now has moved me from my friend's place that I was using, which is her retreat center up in Pennsylvania. My friend Grandma Michelle let me use her 55 acres up there for the winter. And if you want to find out more about how you can use that location as a retreat or some time away for yourself, or if you want to plan some type of conference, you can check out her website, which is called allaboutmytimenow.com. And you can actually see the really beautiful photographs. I really enjoyed my time up there, staying on the property, and decided to come down here to Florida. So I'm actually moved in and living in Orlando, Florida now, and went to my first yoga class today. So got my ass beat quite a bit because it's been about 4 months. And anybody who anybody who's done yoga knows that if you step away from it for a little bit, you know, by the time you get back on the mat and get into a good class, things aren't as flexible as they used to be. So really enjoyed my class today. As always, if you want to find out more about this show and other shows, you can go to our website, which is spiritualconnectionsradio.com. As you know, we had our friend on last week talking about his book, Dancing on a Stamp, just an incredible interview of a Canadian corporate attorney who basically came across his guide as a homeless person on the streets. The replay of that show, if you get a chance to listen to it so far, It was just absolutely an incredible interview to talk to him about his experience of directly meeting his guide in physical form on the streets, and that led to all the information and everything that his guide wanted everybody to know about the nature of where are we, where do we come from, you know, is there a heaven and hell, and all kinds of great information was shared during that interview. So that is featured up on our website, and the replay link is available through our Spiritual Connections Radio link as a feature show now. So if you go up there and click on the link and go to where the show is, you can actually go and replay that show anytime you want. I highly recommend it. And if you haven't had a chance to pick up his book, Dancing on a Stamp, absolutely incredible about all the information. There's basically books that I've come across in spirituality that really kind of give you the pieces that explain what happens after you die to the time you're reborn again. Dancing on a Stamp is one, and a book that I studied quite a long time ago, which is called Journey of Souls, which is written by a gentleman called Newton, is absolutely an incredible book to understand the life between life process. So, you know, make sure to check out those great books and everything. I'm actually upgrading my resource website. As you know, I run a website called spiritualjourneynj.org. It's a site that has recommendations for different practitioners from around the world who provide different types of services. I also have a section up there which has some book recommendations, and I'm right in the process of revamping that website this weekend. So I'll have some really good self-help books up there and some spiritual books that I highly recommend. You know, coming from the fact that I've read probably close to 300 spiritual books now, there's a very specific subset of books that I recommend to people if you're starting your spiritual journey and you're just looking to really get your hands on some books that someone can recommend. I know for a lot of my spiritual journey, the books that have come to me through recommendation, which has led me to where I am today in my spiritual development, has come either because they were given to me by divine intervention, or they were handed to me through individuals who walked up to me one day and said, you know, here's a book that you have to read. And it's always interesting to see how that all works. So if you haven't had a chance to check it out, probably by next week the website will be updated and you can go to spiritualjourneynj.org to check out that site. And with that, I'm really excited to introduce my guest today. Her name is Maria Eisel. Is that how you pronounce your last name, Maria?
That's right, Mark. Eisel.
Yeah. Anybody who listens to the show knows that you leave it up to Mark. I'm going to come up with all kinds of new names for things. And so, Maria, it's great to have you on the show, and welcome to Spiritual Connections Radio.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your having me on. And, boy, that intro was just a fountain of information. I'm so glad I didn't have to take notes. I just put it on a memo, my recorder memo. You know, I mean, amazing. I'd like to interview you and just, I mean, could you do a whole hour of that?
I think
so. Many hours of that, right?
Well, you know, the funny part was I was actually getting a little bit worried. You know, for everybody that was listening, Maria came in. I always tell people to call in probably about 10 minutes before the show starts so I can do the briefing. And Maria was scrambling for the phone number, and it's funny because if you actually check your email after the show, you'll see that about 5 minutes before the show started, I got a hit. You know how guides like to – it's always the thing about knowledge sometimes, or sometimes it has to do with abundance. It's always last minute, and it's like I'm right within 5 minutes, and I get, oh, she can't find the number for the dial-in, so I emailed it to you, and, of course, you had gotten it through one of our friends. And as I'm sitting there, you know, because sometimes people get sick or they forget about the show, it happens, you know.
Sure.
I'm sitting here and I'm going, okay, well, I don't have a replay queued up, so I can't just run a replay because I have to prep for that. And I'm like, all right, I'm just going to have to wing a whole show, you know, and I'll put Marie on next week. And I'm sitting there going, okay, well, what am I going to talk about for an hour? And right in the back of my mind, you know, my guides, of course, talking to me, and they said, well, why don't you talk to people about creating a chart that shows the path of their life and how they can look at, you know, the lessons and all that kind of stuff. And it's actually a coaching exercise that I learned from Denise Lynn when I was doing the soul coaching training out at her ranch. And it's this beautiful exercise that you do. And I was like, yeah, I can make an hour out of that. So,
wow. Just
all right.
That.
So, Marie.
Yes. Yes.
So tell me about your, before we dig into the meat of all this, and of course, we're going to basically talk about healthcare systems. We're going to talk about long-term care and everything. We'll just give all our listeners a heads up on where we're going with the direction of the show for tonight. But before we dig into all this and really get into the meat and potatoes, tell me a little bit about yourself. I mean, how did you get started? What are you, what is your background? Like, are you a registered nurse or, you know, tell me a little bit about how you got started on before you got into all this work.
Well, that's actually an interesting story because I was a pop and jazz singer for quite a few years. And I walked into a nursing home one day, was offered a job as a music specialist. I'd never been in a nursing home before, and I was really saddened, deeply saddened by what I saw. And in a millisecond, one of those instantaneous moments that, you know, your audience certainly will understand, I just knew what my mission in life was, because in less than a second, I thought, well, gee, this is not good, and this shouldn't be rocket science to fix. And I could figure this out. And in about 2 weeks, I did figure out the basics of how to optimally engage people. But it became immediately apparent that that wasn't nearly enough to engage people, to have people become healthier and happier and productive right down to their last moments, to be productive in some way, and everyone can. So I walked into this facility, and as I say, I had this epiphany, and that was it. So in the first, we developed these lifestyle programs, life enrichment programs, you could call them as well. They're oriented to engaging each and every person, regardless of their age or, what kind of living environment they're in, but particularly vulnerable people of any kind. What are their daily lives like? What do they do all day? And this is not rocket science to fix. You know, the programs and services that we've developed are quite obvious, really. It's kind of going back to the tribe, having a strong community orientation that's based on incentives all the way around. We've developed systems to reform the facility care delivery systems, whether that's skilled nursing, county-run, or private or nonprofit. There's a wide gamut of who does what and why in long-term care, frankly. It's a very corrupt industry, every bit as corrupt as any major corporate entity. And it's, you know, that's as much as I'll say here, actually. We figured out how to fix the system and how to make it cost less, much less, literally a fraction of what it currently costs, which is costing every taxpayer, most of the people in nursing homes, it's $84,500 average in this country to keep someone in what, in many places, and this will be controversial, are almost warehouse-like. You know, many of them still are. Certainly, they're quite institutional in nature. Even though care delivery has significantly improved, the quality of life has not improved to the extent that's possible or preferable for anyone in this system or any of their loved ones or community members. And certainly the staff who care for these people, whether it's at home or in a long-term care environment, the people that care for our loved ones and for us are extremely valuable, more valuable than any administrator or office person or executive or professional, you know, a professional that's getting paid professional wages. These people are much more valuable because those other people can be replaced because they're well paid. And the jobs aren't as taxing as what the direct care staff has to deal with. So that's a critical area that has to be addressed. If the care delivery support system is weak, and that's its weakest link, because it's not supported financially or in terms of what people need to better themselves and to have jobs that are not only meaningful, because their jobs are meaningful already, and that's why so many people stay in these especially entry-level positions. In a nursing home, that would be dietary, primarily dietary nurses' aides. They're just not, it's not a high status position, and it should be. And so many of our programs are oriented to support systems of all kinds for direct service personnel, actually all personnel, but in particular the more entry-level people, and to create streams of upward mobility for them that are supported by all kinds of incentives at the community level, at the government level, you know, in every way. We've just developed kind of a very detailed plan of how to fix the system at the home care level and at the facility-based level, and have it cost literally a fraction of what it costs now. And we have to do that because whether or not we fix it right, fact is, the numbers don't work. We cannot continue to pay as much as we're paying for people in long-term care as our generation starts to retire, which they're doing now. How's that for starters? Is that okay?
Yeah, that definitely sounds good. So let me go through and just ask some general questions. I mean, based on the amount of people who are in long-term care facilities and stuff like that, how much of them are basically funding it themselves, meaning when they go in, they're buying into, you know, like a lot of my friends are getting ready to retire, or they're getting to the point that they're looking to move out of their houses and move into a facility where they can have some type of stage living. It actually reminds me a lot of what my grandfather went through on my father's side, and that is when he was ready to move out of his house in Massachusetts, he ended up going down to this very interesting facility down in Pennsylvania. And it was one of those facilities where they, you know, whatever it is, they have like, you know, 50 or 60 acres. And when he first started there, he was in like a duplex house, which was like one of those houses. It looks like a regular house, but it's split in half. So someone has one half and someone has the other, and it has a car garage and all that kind of stuff. And he was there probably for about 6 months. And then after that, he went down the street to one of the big condo buildings, which was like one of these big buildings that was like shared condos. They had shared areas where they could sit and talk to each other. And then there was a cafeteria. And then if you didn't want to eat in the cafeteria, you could just go back to your room. And every room had a kitchen and everything. So people
That's
could
assisted
eat
living.
In
it.
Yeah.
You're talking about continuing care retirement communities, and that the mm-hmm. stage that he came into originally was independent. Then he went to assisted living, where he could have more of his needs met, yet still stay independent. And go on. I'm sorry. I just wanted to clarify that for folks who don't mm-hmm. may not know really what a CCRC is, continuing care retirement community, and what tiers of care they generally provide.
And then after he was in the condo for I think about 7 years, then he went up the street to the facility, which was where he had pretty much 24-hour nursing care. And he, at that point, he had an advanced case of Alzheimer's and everything, so he had a tendency to kind of, I think it happened in the condo portion of it, he'd wander out and he would get locked out of the building or something. He couldn't get back in. It was a cold winter day one day when it happened, so that's when we moved him up the hill to
Really?
Yeah, to what?
That's surprising and really kind of shocking. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, so he, we actually moved him up the hill to what I would call, like, a lot of the area up the hill was the nursing portion of, like, when people would get into the bedridden stages of final, before they pass over. And he was in one of those areas up there, which I called the lockdown area, because the whole, it was an Alzheimer's unit. So everything was locked down. You had to sign people in and out, and everything was watched very carefully. And it was interesting to see that. So as you were explaining before about the different stages, when he went up the hill into that type of level of living, what do they call that?
Skilled care. So he might have been in a dementia unit, a specific dementia unit they have generally for high-functioning people and then for low-functioning people. So it's quite a gamut of what care delivery systems are appropriate for the various stages. So I hope that he was able to go into a specialized dementia unit, because there's a lot more happening there, a lot more attention to engaging people during their day. They can be much better often than the other skilled nursing areas that are strictly geared to physical care.
Well, I think this show is really valuable for a lot of our listeners, because I know a lot of the listeners that are listening in right now are either in a stage of kind of taking care of loved ones in the home, or they're getting ready to make that decision to move a loved one into some type of facility, you know, because of the amount of care they can get. I know there's so many experiences that come from my own family that I'm sharing tonight, and that is, I know for another part of my family, we with my grandmother on my mother's side, we actually kept her in the house. She was very independent into her late 80s. And we actually had a nurse that would come in and actually stay with her. So a lot of what I'm going to ask you is just different questions, because I think, you know, a lot of people who are listening to the show are in this decision-based place of trying to decide how to give the best care to their loved ones in these later stages in life. So I'll ask you a lot of questions. So with my grandmother, where she was staying in the house, and a nurse would come in and kind of stay with her to make sure she was okay, What type of assistance is that?
That's a home and community-based care. That's one of the long-term care services. My understanding is that the Affordable Care Act has mandated 35% of the expenditures to long-term care going forward to be spent on home and community-based care, which is really great. You know, a lot of people who would never have gone into a nursing home, that's people are way more afraid of that than they are of public speaking, which apparently is number one, and certainly more afraid of it than dying. So I'm sorry. Could you ask me that question again?
No, I think you answered it. We were just basically asking what type of care that is. Going back to my original question, I guess what I was asking was, based on the amount of people who were in long-term care, how many of them are like my grandparents, where they had plenty of money and they were just basically funding their own type of care to the time they passed over, versus how much are basically just depending on some type of government-based Medicare or some type of Social Security to pay for long-term care?
Well, the figures are pretty startling, actually. Let's put it this way, and the figures are kind of hard to come by in some ways. For example, recent estimates for the amount spent annually on paid long-term care services in general are between, now listen to this this discrepancy, $210 billion for 2013 and $306 billion. Well, so give or take $100 billion. And that's broken down to all the different different areas, including adult day services, which I'm a big fan of, and feel that that could be that is and should be a very expanded program so that people can stay in their own homes, they can share their homes with others. You know, I'd love to speak about co-housing. That is an essential thing, I think, for elders who want to age in a different way than has recently been recently been options. So the recent options have been you either pay a phenomenal amount of money and, you know, until it runs out, and you hope that you're in a facility that takes Medicaid at that point, which is a big if, especially for the better facilities. So we have to fix these. They're, all roads, frankly, lead back to community. Now, we can get dramatic savings through operational efficiencies and dramatic savings through revenue enhancements, such as I think something your audience would like is having fee-for-service, initially fee-for-service, programs that are holistic in nature, so using alternative modalities, and we hope to partner with local hospitals and who have alternative clinics, such as Morristown locally for us, has, I believe, a fairly robust alternative medicine system. Now, they're not going against, I'm not talking about cancer cures and things like that, which, frankly, they should be, I think. But it's a place to start. And there have to be, it all has to be integrated, and we have to support each other and ultimately have new community programs. It takes a village, programs and systems that will mean that nobody's bankrupted by their care delivery. And everybody takes care of everybody else. Everybody gives what they have to give and gets back what they need or want. And the way that you make that happen is in part through technology. We've got the ability to do that now. We have the know-how and we have the ability. The fact that the system, our systems are so out of whack is not because people don't know how to fix them, as you well know. It's because the systems are so corrupt and not oriented to the community. The book called Spirit Level, and it talks about, I believe that's the name of it, it talks about the fact that improving the world for the rich improves their world too, because they're otherwise they're always living in a precarious environment. So this is part of that. So, as I say, all roads lead back to community. We can get significant savings right off the bat. We don't have to, you know, reinvent our world order to do that. We can get 30% savings is what we've committed to paper and offered to CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid, which is the federal, you know, the overarching federal agency. We hope that our certification for nursing homes, assisted living, CCRCs, the continuing care retirement communities, home and community-based service models, including home care agencies and adult day services, that our certification will ultimately become, or something like it, but so far, as far as I know, we have the only system that will achieve what the certification will promise. And we hope that that will ultimately become the acceptable accountability measure for the highest practicable care in any setting, long-term care setting in particular.
Okay. All right, let's go ahead and take a break. We just want to let everybody know you're listening to Spiritual Connections Radio, and we're talking about healthcare And I'm going to go ahead and give out Maria's website, which is www.cscs-cares.com. So that's ccs-cares.com. And, of course, you're listening to Spiritual Connections Radio, and our main show is always on Thursday nights from 9:30 to 10:30. And to find out more about our show and see more about the people we have on and the guests and everything, what's coming up over the next couple months, you can go to our website at spiritualconnectionsradio.com. All shows that you listen to are available in archives, and you can get to that through our main site. And then once you're up on Blog Talk Radio for Spiritual Connections, you can go through the archives, and all our shows for the last year are up there and available for everybody to see. So before we get back into talking about healthcare, I want to kind of sidebar, Maria, with you for a second and talk about what you kind of touched on there for a second. And I'll just phrase it as a question, and that is, how are we doing out there? And because, you know, there's all of us out there in the spiritual industry that want to basically be able to, you know, do our Reiki or something for a client and have them be able to write it off on their insurance, or want to be able to walk into a hospital and know that if we're in the hospital for something, that not only can we see our doctors, but we can also have a holistic introduction of that, you know, while we're there also. So I guess when it relates to insurance companies covering alternative medicine, or hospitals offering it, I mean, where are we? What's the snapshot look like right now?
Well, I'm really excited that you asked me that, because one of the programs that I know is going to be so so exciting and so profitable for the long-term care providers, at least initially, it's really important that we, you know, they become solvent. What currently exists, the long-term care industry as it exists, as it needs to be changed, it needs to be kept solvent. So these new revenue streams of all kinds will be very helpful. So as I mentioned before, fee-for-service holistic modalities and having each facility, each community-oriented facility providing the opportunity for people to not only receive these modalities, the residents, of course, the caregivers, the staff, all the staff has access and all kinds of incentives to avail themselves of all these different modalities that we have already, and the people in those who are providing those services, we intend to do lots of background research on them, make sure we've got the best people and that we can provide them the best services, which would be insurance. They could come in under CCS's insurance in any given location where our services are being provided. And they'll know that they don't have to deal with marketing or any such thing. They just come to the facility that is now a place that's more like a community center that everybody flocks to, because everyone's desires and needs are met there, and would love to expand on that too. This is one aspect of it, that the holistic modalities that are offered there, and of course, you're talking about some very cool stuff that, you know, some of us have had the opportunity to be associated with. I mean, the many years that I've been practicing meditation, of course, and so many of us have, have been virtually vegetarian since I was 15 years old. And, boy, it's really paying off now, you know. I thought this company would be off the ground sooner than it was. I've been very fortunate to be supported in various ways by lots of people and have a great management team, so we're excited about finally getting off the ground. But I think that providing the holistic modalities, not only to the residents, and as I said, the caregivers, but also the local community, and of course at fee for service for everyone initially. That's the way it would have to be. But if we have folks under an umbrella, so, and they're providing education to the community as well, or various communities as well, and that's monetary enhancement or enhancement and encouragement to them as well. These folks can really just have they can get benefits. They don't have to worry about anything except showing up to provide their services and being part of a community that really values them. So, you know, I'm glad you asked me about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the interesting things I noticed as a practitioner, especially one who travels around the country quite a bit, is that as you go to different parts of the country, and I'll use New York and Florida as an example. In New York and Florida, Reiki practitioners generally have to go to some type of school, and I think both states are doing this as far as, when I mean both states, I mean Reiki people in both states seem to be doing a common thing, and that is Reiki people in New York have basically gone to get their massage licenses. And the reason for that is in the state of New York, you cannot touch somebody unless you have some type of license. So the people right. who got certified to do Reiki were kind of like, well, you know, normally the workaround for most spiritual people is just to sign up with a ordained minister type of license and become an ordained minister. And then generally with those credentials in most parts of the United States, you then have the right to touch somebody because of it. Now, of course, we could get into the whole philosophy of, you know, or the whole idea behind, you know, and I'm using Reiki, but we could be talking about any of the 1,000 healing modalities that are out there. You can basically do pretty much all of them without touching somebody. Doesn't require that you touch somebody, but you know, a lot of people like that physical touch when they are having their healing sessions, and
well, sure.
some practitioners feel that that is a big part of the work they do. So I just basically where I was going with this is I've noticed in some of the states, I think California is pretty strict also, and I know Florida is. In Florida, you can't touch anybody without a license. So for a lot of these places, and, you know, to be honest with you, it's not even about worrying about what these spiritual practitioners are doing. It is actually more about politics and money. And, you know, as an example, in the state of Florida, it's about the massage lobbyists and stuff like that. And I just never uh-huh. understood the politics behind that one. But I'm just wondering as we go into the future if we're going to have to, you know, a lot of what we're going to talk about in a few minutes about the reforming and coming up with these standards for long-term care and the health industry, I just wonder if there's a certain point where spiritual people are going to have to be licensed.
Well, you know, part of what we're excited about is that we can provide documentation that is irrefutable regarding the outcomes of all kinds of things, including holistic modalities, because we've oriented our own metric system, the Conscious Care System has, to the federal government's own metric system, which they're called resident assessment instruments, and they are these very long forms in nursing homes and in home health agencies, not companion agencies, but health agencies. And these resident assessment instruments are quite comprehensive as to an individual's mental and physical status at any given time. And they have to be filled out quarterly unless there's a significant change in a person. And all this information and then they have to be done more frequently if there's a significant change. All this information goes directly to the federal government through CMS and through a software vendor, a long-term care, special long-term care software vendor of which there are many. All that information is utilized as these are these assessment tools are called the resident assessment instruments or tools are, for example, the MDS, the minimum data set for nursing homes, and OASIS is for home care. These are the metrics that we use because the federal government uses them. They're quite comprehensive, which is great. And so we can document each person's progress in the cognitive and in their physiological experience. So we feel that ultimately that this could be extremely important for the proponents of integrated medicine, because you've got people who are highly regulated already. And if you use the federal government system of regulation to prove the outcomes, nobody can refute those. So we've front-loaded our programs to be psychosocial in nature so that each person has really a great lifestyle no matter what their mental or physical status is or where they are, and that the caregivers are really happy and upwardly mobile and everybody gets paid enough and facilities become like community centers, the communities in which people live become neighborhoods, and all of that is supported extensively by technology and frankly, some of the best business minds in the business that we've been so fortunate to attract to our substantial management team, which I don't know if you had a chance to look at that, but Mark, there are some amazing people on our team, and that's because they understand the very comprehensive and rigorous plan of action that we have to implement a paradigm-changing system. But you start with very innocuous lifestyle enhancements and then utilize these resident assessment instruments to document those, and that includes all kinds of holistic modalities and nutrition and people can choose what they want, but the outcomes will be so significant that you can't refute them. As I said, that's we feel sure that'll happen, and it's a third rail in long-term care to discuss anything alternative in nature. For example, SAMe as a mood enhancer, which virtually everybody needs once they are experiencing serious mood issues. Mm-hmm. And people do as they get older. They lose a lot. Even if they weren't losing their own physical or mental health, they lose people. They know that, aging is tough. I don't care who you are. And
what kind of advancements are we seeing in hospice care?
Oh, I think they're using some alternative modalities, and I think they're actually more open to a lot of the Reiki type and more esoteric even types of modalities. But for the most part, those are private pay and ancillary to the other more traditional treatments, and not treatments, but care that they give. So,
mm-hmm. What is, as far as someone who might be looking for a place to place a loved one for care, what are some of the, maybe the three or four top red flags that people should be looking for when they're evaluating some type of facility for long-term care?
That's a great question. I would say, people always talk about smell, and for the most part, it's true. If there's a very pungent smell, frankly, mm-hmm. then that would be some cause for concern. But it depends. Sometimes there's a change of there's a certain time when many people are being changed. So if you come in at that very moment, that's one thing. But if you come in hours later, to me, that's something else. And aromatherapy can certainly cover up anything that's unavoidable you know, through the most strenuous hygienic measures. And those should all be carried out in every facility. And I would say most facilities try to do that. They certainly try to do that. And it's tough. And again, there's lots of ways to not only minimize the onerous nature of what these really, to me, heroic certified nurse aides do, in caring for our most vulnerable people who have lost many of their, what they call ADLs, activities of daily living, which is like being able to bathe and groom yourself and, you know, whether you're able to ambulate or transfer yourself from one place to the other, a number of things that are pretty basic. We need to address the fact that the system needs to help people achieve the highest level of care no matter how bad they are. That's what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we were looking for some red flags to look out for when we're trying to evaluate a new place. So we have, you know, just watching out for the smell. What else were we looking for?
But yeah, that's one. So hopefully that's not going to be a major thing for most people. And so really it's a matter of going into the facility and trying to observe as much as possible, become involved in whatever's happening there. Hang out in the areas that are congregate. Are there people in those congregate areas? Or are they all in their rooms because there's nothing happening? Because they're too afraid to leave their rooms, many of these people. I've written a document called The Facade of Assisted Living. And the terrible truth is, and this has been corroborated now finally by a number of studies, but people want to live in long-term care because it seems more home-like and you know, high-end-like, which they are. They're more high-end. They're really nice. They seem like more like residences and have lovely community areas and often are in they're built to look like old houses and that kind of thing. But often, in fact, for the most part, I believe, the care delivery is very limited because they were designed to provide limited care delivery. But what has happened is with the proliferation of many freestanding assisted living facilities, you have a lot of people are not getting the care that they need because they need more care coming in, and then they age there. So now they really need more care, but the facilities are often torn about releasing them into a skilled environment, which is what they need at that point, because of financial concerns. And so they try to meet their needs where they are, but some do anyway. But I've had aides call me and crying over the phone saying, I can't even help get these people out of bed, which meant they would stay in bed all day, because I have 30 residents to attend to. So, frankly, I'm going to check tomorrow on what the ratio is nationally. Mm-hmm. I know I believe that to be a very low ratio of caregivers to high volume of people who need care. Going back to your red flags, to go into the facility or even CCRC, which are really nice. They look really nice, but you want to see what happens there all day too. They may have a lot of so-called activities that are listed. This is more common in nursing homes than in the CCRCs. CCRCs do tend to have better life-enriching opportunities for people, especially who are high functioning. You want to find out how robust are the programs that are going on. So I would talk to the activities personnel, to the director, make sure you get an activities calendar, and try to be there when these activities are ongoing and notice when they're not ongoing or when what's listed in on the calendar is more euphemistic for something else. Oftentimes you'll see, you know, it's really not a program. It's just, you know, they try to fill up some of these slots because the requirements nationally for people being involved, residents of long-term care institutions in particular, of having the opportunity for social activities is extremely limited. In some states, it's an hour per resident per week. So you're talking about a person who the activities personnel are ostensibly responsible for the everyday experience and lifestyle of the persons in long-term care, but they don't have the resources to do that. They don't have a codified system to do that, and that's part of what we've designed. So there's so many elements to what makes up a facility. So certainly you want to become as cognizant as you can of what's happening, what's the caliber of what is happening, how often is it happening, how accessible is it to most of the residents, and how accessible will it be for the person that you are, if it's you yourself, which I would recommend to people that they look into CCRCs as soon as possible, and even better, co-housing communities that are looking at aging in place together. But finding out what is the gestalt of the community, however you want to do that, and certainly there are many ways to do that, that's critical. Finding out what kind of people they are, what is it that your loved one needs? Do they have dementia issues? How good is a dementia unit? And how appropriate for your loved one, especially if you only have one? Are the physical needs going to be best met in any given facility? If that's the primary diagnosis for someone, that they're physically unable to care for themselves. So there are many things to look at. One thing I would highly recommend is just to I'll just finish that sentence that I highly recommend is to go into the facility at night and see what's going on then. Are there sufficient staff number? Are the staff that are supposed to be there, are they there? Are they performing? I found staff people, frankly, sleeping on a regular basis at night. And you know what? It's just, what do you do? It's very hard to find people. It really is.
Yeah. I think it's interesting in a lot of cultures. I know with my ex-wife who was Chinese, the family took care of the grandparents. And I think for a lot of cultures, you see that. You see the support is that the elders are kept in the house. It's this feeling of a value of having that wisdom in the house and just kind of seeing that type of care. I think for a lot of families, though, it's very hard if that you're the only one in the house and you're trying to take care of your great grandmother or your mother or something like that, and then all of a sudden she falls down and breaks a hip or something like that, and then you realize, how much time it takes to actually take care of somebody full-time. So I think it's interesting to see the dynamics between different cultures and their belief systems in taking care of people. As we kind of wrap up the show, why don't you talk to me about CCS and where it's going and, what's hot right now?
What's hot? Well, we hope we are. We're looking at a number of options for implementing a pilot program in a local facility. That pilot program is, we expect it to trigger our funding, our second round of funding, I should say, with the capital markets crowd, but some of the good guys. There's a few good guys out there. And So once we're on site in a local facility and documenting our outcomes, even in the first few weeks, we'll be able to use the resident assessment instruments to document our outcomes. So once that's happening, we expect to have that trigger our funding. And that's really exciting because then we get to move into a ramp-up phase, which is a three-month phase of training and developing programs and our 1.0 software system and all kinds of really great things. We want to spend, as I say, 3 months to do that, and then start on a very aggressive rollout schedule, because if in fact we can save the kind of money that we actually have committed to paper, and when I say we, I mean some people with you know, really amazing credentials. So we can. We're hoping that this pilot will exceed our expectations in terms of outcomes, and that we'll be able to move forward expeditiously and roll out as fast as possible this new system that will not only ensure optimal lifestyles for people in any care delivery situation, but also to help to salvage the economy, which really is being ravaged. And let me just say one thing about the fact that these young people who are coming out of college today, including my own children, dealing with college situations, people are the student loan crisis is growing by leaps and bounds. So these young people are coming out of college with these huge debts. And the reason for that, as Lamar Alexander, good Republican that he is, he said that he could answer in one word why these kids are coming out of college with these huge debts. And he said it's Medicaid, and he's right. Medicaid is growing at a 10% a year, average 10% a year level. And now with the Affordable Care Act, it's going to grow even faster, but that's should be offset by other things. But the fact is, Medicaid is it's a fantastic program, but it's very expensive, and especially with long-term care. So, again, we have to reduce the cost of long-term care, and we have to have people live healthier lives. That's the other reason Medicaid is so expensive. It's because of it's about, I think it's about half and half now, where in terms of expenditures for elderly people and for the rest of the population. But any way you slice it, that's a big number. And in New York State, it hovers at 40 to 50% of the entire massive New York State budget, 41% in 2012. So a lot of scary statistics out there. So the only way to solve these formerly intractable problems are certainly to come up with new paradigms. You know, we can't fix an old system that was built on an old paradigm. It's just not working. And I really appreciate, again, Mark. Thank you so much.
All right, go ahead and give out your website to everybody so they can find out more.
Again, my name is Marie Eisele, E-I-S-E-L-E. The company is Conscious Care Systems. The website is CCS, C as in cat, C as in cat, S as in Sam, hyphen cares with an S. C-A-R-E-S, CCS-cares.com. Certainly put in my name, Marie Eisele, E-I-S-E-L-E. My LinkedIn site will come up, and whatever else you want to know. Thank you so much for your consideration. I know.
It was great having you on, Marie. You have a great night, and thanks for being on Spiritual Connections Radio.
Yeah, God bless you.
Good night,
everybody. Thank you so much.
Good night. Okay, good night, everybody.